more information about this episode, just think about all the stuff you've heard about child trafficking and sex trafficking, and then pretty much throw most of it out the window, because it's closer to home than you think, and there's a lot more advice that can help prevent it than you know. Well, it's more than you know, but Amanda knows, and she's going to give you some helpful tips and share some insight on trafficking that you don't know, because she's one of the professionals. So this is the introduction. The rest of the episode is about to begin now.
Hey, my name is Larry Ife. Welcome to White, Confused, Black, and Christian, the podcast. This is episode 180, and I am with Amanda Corbin. I met her on LinkedIn because I saw she had a lot to do with trafficking. And you know I like to deal with people that are not just talking about it, they're actually doing it. She's actually doing it, a licensed social worker. We had a lot of things in common, so I reached out to her, and I wanted to get some professional views from her. She's one of those people that's doing it, like I said, and I'll let her introduce herself. But this is Amanda Corbin.
Awesome. Hey, Larry, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm glad you found me on LinkedIn. I always tell people I swear by LinkedIn because, I mean, we meet people that we'd never meet elsewhere. I've met amazing, you know, people in recovery, people in the anti-trafficking fight, and it's just a really... it's a professional setting to collaborate. And there's a gentleman that I found, you know, and he calls it, there's collectors and connectors. It's good to find the connectors, you know, those are the doers. So I started anti-trafficking as a natural progression of what I've done for 20 years. So I started working in nonprofits and social services back in 2000 with like the YMCA and Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ophelia Project, all, you know, community-based services. And along that, I got my bachelor's and my master's in social work. So I started private counseling. A lot of the work that I did with most of, you know, my clients, there always seemed to be a sexual abuse, sexual trauma history. So that just kind of built upon my personal hit, you know, my personal journey. And then in 2016, I had a friend of mine reach out and they're like, hey, have you ever considered working anti-trafficking? And I'm like, well, you know, my heart's more, you know, sexual abuse prevention, healthy kids, safe families, but I'll consider it. And then of course, the more you explore it, trafficking is just a greater perversion of the exact same spectrum. So it's very much allowed me to continue in my heart and my passion. So 2016, I actually opened the first safe home for sex trafficked males in Florida, which was huge because back in 2016, we weren't really recognizing males as victims at all. So it was really helping to pave the way there. And I did that for a couple years, but I'm both married with kids, and we were laughing. I have four dogs right now. So my husband and I have seen, we've seen people do so much in ministry and in the world outside their house that their family and their own home falls. And I'm not willing to do that. So running that home finally started tipping the scale in a direction I didn't want it to. So I bowed out of that. Started working at USF. I've been teaching part-time in their School of Social Work for a couple years. Still work with counseling. I work with survivors. And then this year I came on board with the Trafficking in America Task Force. And there I work strongly in their targeted prevention, but then I'm also VP of operations. So we're working with developing extended services for survivors of sex trafficking as well. So that catches you up to now.
What? Well, I never knew that there was, like you mentioned earlier about the males, I never knew that they get, so what, these are males that get sex trafficked?
Yeah. So, I mean, just like, because, you know, what is it? The current statistics are, you know, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 girls are sexually abused and 1 in 6 men are sexually abused. If those are even accurate statistics, and the same with sex trafficking, you know, in its most simple definition, when you're talking about sex trafficking with minors, so that's under the age of 18, if there is ever exchange of anything of value, for a sex act, that exchange is trafficking. Even if the child is having to, if the child is the recipient of the drugs, you know, or if the child is the recipient of the housing and sex dad, so stepdad, you know, requires, you know, that his stepdaughter allows him to molest her so she stays in the house, housing has value. So by definition, that exchange of anything of value. So that, all the more reason is why sexual abuse is on the same spectrum. So how many sexual abuse cases was there actually something leveraged of value that it actually would fit the basic definition of trafficking of a minor?
Wow. See, that's why I want to talk to a professional. I love talking to pros because, well, matter of fact, let me back up a little bit. I know you're a professional. I sent you a podcast episode called I Pedophile.
Oh, yep.
And I did that because of the fact that I admitted I had an alcohol problem. That was cool, like I said. Then a drug problem was a little bit hard to admit, especially because I didn't blow and I didn't crack. Nobody wants to admit the crack.
Nope.
So that was real difficult. But the hardest part for me was, so now I'm past that stuff. I started dealing with my sexual addictions, and that was the very hardest part, because anytime you mention anything about that, people want to, before you even say what it is, people are like, oh, I did tell one of my close friends, and she's like, you're a predator, you're a pedophile, you're a stalker, you're a this, you're a that, and right then and there, you shut down. You don't want to tell anybody anything, but it exists, and I'm at the point with my spirituality now where I always like to use the Bible. In the book of Timothy or James, it says, openly confess to one another.
Yep.
The Bible is a simple book. Once you openly confess and talk about something, it doesn't make it go away, but it makes it easier to discuss. So that's why I shout out to you as a professional, because nobody's talking about it. I thought I wanted to hear somebody talk about it from a professional standpoint and just get out of it.
So, I'll say two things. One, to what you just said about scripture. So, yes. Professionally speaking, secrets only have their power in the dark.
Yeah.
That's what makes them secrets.
Yeah.
You know? So, moving to your podcast, and right off the bat, I pedophile, I'm kind of like, okay, so in my head, let me prepare myself for trigger warning. Like, I'm kind of like, where's he going with this one? I appreciated your authenticity, because in hearing it and in the victims and survivors that I've worked with, literally my brain went to, this is you trying to control your trauma. That's where, because it's establishing dominance. And many people would disagree with me, but it's the same reason we've got so many women who feel empowered in strip clubs.
Yep. Yeah.
You know? Because it sure as hell feels good to decide when a man is gonna do this or do that, when previously you weren't the one deciding.
Yeah. See?
Which is not a popular opinion, but whatever.
if it works, hey.
And it makes good money. And so it's like, it is really hard to get people out of a position when they're controlling their trauma. They're making good money doing it, you know, and they're not willing to heal. Because the only way you're going to get out of something is if you're really willing to look at the root. Just like, you know, both with your iPedophile, and then I listened to the recent one with Josh Shea. And, you know, we got to quit looking at symptoms as the problems and symptoms as the root, because they're not. The root of porn, you know, like Josh was saying, was, it's some form of trauma. It's some form of inadequacy. It's some form of needing your ego stroked, which goes back to childhood and those developmental aspects and what needs were and were not met, versus just, you know, oops, I fell into porn and now I'm addicted. Like, meh. But why did it go toward an addiction?
So do you, and I'm gonna tell you a little secret here. Well, not a secret anymore. Part of the secret is when I talked about it and shared that with you, it's because I believe there is a direct link. This is my unprofessional view, and there's a direct link between child trafficking and pornography. And I say that simply because you hear about a lot of young kids getting sex trafficked or whatever. And I know me, with my pornography, it was getting worse and worse and worse. You know, you start off looking at, you know, a MILF.
Yep.
Two MILFs, then a MILF and her college daughter. Then, like I said, it gets progressively worse and worse and worse. Next thing you know, you look at younger females, and now you're like, oh my gosh. And that's what really snapped me out of the whole porn thing, when I started to look at those younger females in real life. Like, okay, I got nipples in the butt right now, and I'm on a spiritual path. I got to stop us. I got to figure something out. But if that goes unchecked, and you start looking at the things you look at in pornography in real life, and you view women as objects, or females, or boys, or whatever it is, as objects, that to me is that's a lot harder to come back from. I mean, pornography is hard to come back from, but once you cross that line, it's a reality. Your fantasy becomes a reality.
Yep. 100%. And that's what, you know, what people don't know about porn is, you know, porn really is like that first hit of any hard drug. You can never come back to that greatest high, that first high, which is why y'all were so candid to share. It has to get worse for you to keep that level of highness, you know? And so, no, you never look at the same porn twice. So absolutely. So porn feeds into sex trafficking through a lot. I mean, a lot of arenas. I mean, there's adults who've come forward and, you know, even as adults, they talked about feeling leveraged. If there's force, fraud, or coercion over the age of 18 for a sex act and somebody else is financially benefiting, that also is trafficking. So how many porn stars do we know that there's either force, fraud, or coercion? If there's provision of drugs, you know, or something, and then someone else is financially benefiting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm with you.
Hey. You know? So, and then yesterday, listening, I mean, y'all were so on point, and I'm just kind of like, I'm so glad we were talking today. So, yeah, another thing that you and Josh, and this was the most recent, the 150-something or the most recent podcast number, you can tell.
Yeah, like 177, I believe, was me and Josh from 178, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, the other thing that came up was we do have a culture that is desensitized to nudity. So if they are desensitized to nudity, if the family structure is failing these children, and if where the children are feeling edified, validated, and seen has to do with, you know, them using their body of some sort, the benefit outweighs, you know, the means. And so you've got these kids almost willingly, but it's because they've got these deficits. So there's no such thing as choice when you're meeting a basic need of feeling loved. It's that, you know, you'll hear the term child prostitute. That doesn't exist. A child can't be a prostitute. A child is a victim of rape. A child is exploited by men and women, but a child isn't a prostitute. They're not willingly selling themselves.
I think you're saying that, okay.
Yeah, and so that entertains that idea of survival sex. Like, survival sex is where, you know, you're engaging in sex acts to meet a basic need. If you've ever heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, love it. So Maslow's, Erikson stages of development, and adverse childhood experiences. Those are like the three key components to really get your head around why kids are victim to and targets of trafficking. So with Maslow's, I mean, how easy is it if a kid's not getting their basic needs met? So all, you know, a buyer, a trafficker, a predator, you know, a porn producer has to do is find a way to meet any of their basic needs.
Yep.
And then if the kid, especially how easy is it if the kid is already desensitized, that nudity is normal.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, it's just a floodgate, you know. Fish in a barrel is where we're at right now with these kids, with all these targets of broken homes, right?
So that brings up another point that I'm not sure if Josh and I talked about it, but I talked about it with somebody before. This broken home, I want to call it a broken home syndrome, I guess, or situation.
Oh, it's like a pandemic, a public health issue.
Yes. That seems to be the core of, like you said, the trafficking. Mm-hmm. Based on our definition of trafficking, it seems to be the basis of that. It seems to be the basis of drug addiction. Even when it comes to drug sales, people sell drugs. Why? They're in a certain community, that's all they have. Drug sales meets their basic needs. They're focused on their basic needs. And if people are always quick to say, you shouldn't be selling drugs, you shouldn't be showing your body, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. But
you got another way for me to pay my bills and feed my babies.
There it is.
I get it. Go ahead.
I focus on what is the you work for American Task Force, American Trafficking. What do you work for again?
No, it's the Trafficking in America Task Force.
So what do you guys focus on helping people that have been in it, or do you actually go after traffickers, or do you look for solutions like we just talked about, like trying to work on creating a more stable home life?
We are less about what law enforcement. So law enforcement is doing, they're doing good things, like down, because I'm in Florida. So down here in Florida, you know, every other day you've got a sheriff of a local county, you know, showing here's a drug bust of 100, or not a drug bust, you know, trafficking bust of 178, you know, individuals, 44 individuals. So law enforcement is doing a great job kicking down doors, you know. Recovery, like street outreach and recovery, there's organizations that are doing good jobs there. What Trafficking in America Task Force, our initiatives really are, and specifically I speak a lot to sex trafficking, but we do address both labor and sex trafficking. And our executive director, Jerome Elam, he travels internationally speaking. So he's been to 7 countries. It's not just America, but in America, the focuses are, the first is targeted prevention. So that's what I'm talking to you about, is this is the sort of thing that if we helped families get well, we would take targets off our kids' backs. We know that an incarcerated parent is a risk factor for a kid. We know that mental illness in the home, drug use in the home, domestic violence, any form of neglect, any form of abuse, these are just targets on kids' backs. And so we've given up on that. And instead of addressing a healthy family, you've just got people complaining that the system ain't raising kids well. Well, how about we quit? It ain't the system's a freaking government. They're not made to be parents.
It's the home. Everything starts in the home.
Yeah. And so that's that targeted prevention. It's like, let's equip families, because if we did this, law enforcement does their stuff, recoveries do theirs, and then we equip families, we really could stop trafficking in a couple generations.
What you just said makes it so simple but so complicated. People don't believe that. A happy home eliminates so many things. You got mom and dad there, and the home is happy, and maybe a bloodhound or a nice little dog, you know, something like a nice little pet. When you've got those conditions, your kids have a different mentality, and it just gives you structure. Let me go off track for one quick second here. The structure of a family is very important as well. You know, nowadays we have different kinds of structures. I believe love is love, but there's no structure that's like the natural structure of a man and a woman there. And you know, the boy learn from the man, and the girl learn from the mom. A family unit stops a lot of stuff.
It does. And the three words that I use are healthy, safe, and stable in a home. If you want your kids to grow up and be strong, stable, contributing members of society, they need to grow up in a healthy, safe, and stable home. So that targeted prevention is one huge initiative, because that's my passion in my heart. A second initiative is that extended recovery. We have a tendency in the recovery field for survivors, that if we get them housing or if we get them a job or both, then all right, they're on their own. But the thing is, when you're dealing with survivors who were trafficked through their adolescence and maybe still have, you know, a middle school education, but now they're in their 30s, you know, a single parent with a couple kids, where are the services to help these parents finish high school, get a degree? Because otherwise they're always going to be at entry-level positions. They're stuck in survival mode.
Right.
We need to do better for survivors. Like, you know, okay, you're on your own. Yeah, but the years, what trauma does to the brain tears up the person. And so just by getting somebody housing and a job, you haven't helped them move into, you know, kind of the term is thriving. You know, you've stabilized them, but recovery goes past stabilization.
Right. Oh yeah.
You know, so that's our thing, is this second part. Great. Companies or agencies are stabilizing, but coming alongside and having, you know, the victims, I've got a couple that, you know, what do we do next? You know, do you need additional education? Do you need a better job for your future goals? You know, we have the privilege of saving. Do survivors have the privilege of saving, or are they living paycheck to paycheck still? That's not helping.
No, because then back in that mode, like you said, that trigger, Maslow, hey, I need more food.
Good old Uncle Maslow.
Yeah, it'll get you every time.
Yeah.
So what do you guys, does your organization offer these services? Do you guys say, let's say I was sex trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys work with housing places to get me stable, and with counselors or with jobs, or do you guys have a system in play?
So right now, I think of the people that I'm working with. So the goal, I mean, right now we are kind of a two-man band, you know, three people. You know, we have our survivor coordinator up in Michigan. We've got the president, he's in Gainesville, and then I'm in the Tampa area. But our outreach and stuff, the survivor coordinator, she's just connecting with survivors via social media and supporting them and finding resources. So the third arm is a lot of collaboration. I met a 30-year-old male a couple of months ago, and he was victim of severe sexual trauma and trafficking. So we don't directly provide housing, but it was kind of, I guess, linkage services is the easiest thing for me to think of what we do with survivors. So I was able to link him to a local organization that provides housing and case management, because he's very much still at that base level. You know, and then the other individuals that I know, what we don't have yet, and what our initiative with serving survivors is literally providing a training and education component. So then they do go to the task force, you know, local office, where we've got a leadership certificate that they get to work on the computer, or just getting them the check that gets them into the local GED program. Because we don't have to reinvent the wheel if we're just a pass through to get them where they need to. The frustrating thing is there's not enough services. And really, if you're an adult survivor and a male, even if you were trafficked as a minor, man, the minute you turn 18, and that's frustrating.
Well, you made me think of something now, because what we're doing here, I'm in Michigan also,
okay,
Muskegon Heights area, Grand Rapids, and what we're trying to do now is connect as many dots as possible, like you said. So we come across an organization like yours, we want to be in a position where we can say, okay, so you're in what, Tampa, you say?
Yep.
So if you're in Tampa and you come across somebody that's in sex traffic or whatever, and they need housing, we want to be in a position where in that Tampa area, within 50 miles or so, whatever, we have bought one of these old schools or an apartment complex where we can have a year-round academy, give a person 1 year, get that certificate, good
yep.
food, they're stable, they get counselors, therapists, et cetera, for a year, and then they graduate into an actual work program. So that's something we're working on too. So I'm going to make a point to contact your court.
Yeah.
Because we started doing that all over the place. Matter of fact, we have partnerships. You're in Tampa, we buy a building in Tampa, somewhere near you, and you can help direct things.
Well, isn't that serendipitous?
See?
That's awesome. But yes, it's fascinating. And the certificates, and they're just so much needed, and how empowering they are, you know, because survivors are such experts in field, and it's so humbling to, and I mean, you and I are both survivors. We both have our own stories, you know, but my story is not someone else's story. So when I get a glimpse of what someone has endured and encountered, and yet here they are, you know, and, you know, and a place at the table, it's, you know, and it checks me of, I deserve to be at the table too. But like, man, when I start to hear somebody's story, sometimes I'm kind of like, I don't need to be at this table. Like it's just humbling to be around such resilience and survivorship. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. That's when they say you graduate from school high notch, you know, school of real life. You don't have a real degree, but you know how to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Now let me ask you this. So based on our conversation, based on what I showed you with the iPedophile thing, I want to circle back to that again because I'm very curious. One lady said to me, you shouldn't tell people, you should lead off with a podcast like that or episode like that, because it's just too much of a shock. I want to ask you, how hard is it? I mean, how hard is it for you to deal with these kind of cases? I mean, you probably get some extreme cases. Do you ever deal with do you ever deal with a trafficker or not?
Not preferably.
See, that's what I'm saying. That's the hard, that part is, what can you do with a trafficker? I'm here. Talk to me.
I'm not. There is research and air quotes out there that says everyone can be changed. Everyone's restorable. Everyone, you know. However, in my experience, I have not found someone to really authentically, vulnerably change course from being a trafficker or a pedophile. But in listening to your podcast, there's a different story, because maybe we say there's two different types, and pedophile is different than predator.
Yeah, there's all different. I'm pretty much the wrong word. I just said it because it's just the only word I know for somebody.
Shock factor. It's fine. It's the shock factor. But when a pedophile and a predator is reliving their own trauma for sake of trying to control the trauma, then I believe there's hope for restoration, because the root is trauma. The root is dealing with a broken individual. When you're dealing with someone who has narcissistic or sociopathic or entitlement personality disorder, is there change there?
I see what you're saying.
You know, and now, trauma or no trauma, there's never excuse for victimizing or violating another. So even if someone's been a victim, they're still accountable if they victimize others.
Yeah.
And so that's that tough, because quite often there's victimizing others before you seek your own trauma and healing.
Yeah.
But, and so then there's this double whammy of processing, you know, a guilt over here, but then needing to address the original wound over here.
See, that trafficking thing is not, that's why I'm glad you focus on preventive stuff, because once you get into either trafficking or being trafficked, whatever it is, or addiction, once you get into something based on trauma, it's just a nightmare. Because yep, right now, yep. I hear what you're saying, and it sounds kind of complicated because there's so many different, I don't know the word. It's hard to say. Yeah. There's so many things with it. Yeah.
And it's hard to, I think one of the, I went through a period that one of my greatest fears, because monsters hide in plain sight, you know, a personal disclosure, like my offender lived within the family. It's not my direct family unit, but my offender was at family gatherings for 20 years, even after I told the story. Yep. So, you know, so for me, I never want to validate a monster or a perpetrator in front of a victim, because what that, and but we don't know that we're doing that. And so, but if a victim is told, you know, and minimized, if they're told this is normal, this is appropriate, this is okay, even if it doesn't jive with their internal clock, right? Their internal compass. But then they go and I'm in community and I'm just talking to an adult and the kids there watching me, but then here I am, a trusted adult to the child, talking to this adult. Now that kid is like, well, if Miss Amanda's talking to him, then I guess he's normal. Well, then you're right, maybe I'm wrong. And that's how these kids internalize. They're the problem.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's, so we really have to be careful, like, you know, and there, it's fascinating when, I mean, there's agencies that I know of that serve both victims and offenders in the same, you know, like domestic violence treatment centers. If somebody's court mandated to domestic violence counseling, the offender could be showing up in the same counseling center as the victim, because the victim, who might be the mom, is also charged with failure to protect, just because the kid witnessed the violence of dad perping against mom. But then, so how confusing is it for this woman, who actually was the victim, walking into a counseling center where the perp is being treated equally? But then you're causing an imbalance, because you're exacerbating the power of the perpetrator.
Yeah.
And that, so once a perpetrator's willing to, if they get to the point of like you did in your podcast, this happened to me and I saw the root of why I went there in my addiction. Okay, well then now you were able to play it backwards. Mm-hmm. In a good way, you know, and retrace your steps. And another thing that's interesting is with your what came to mind with that? It'll come back to me. Sorry.
Oh, you got time. There's so much. Trust me, I tell you, I had three questions for you, and now I have none, because now you said something else, and now I'm thinking about all these different paths of.
Yep.
This trafficking is, and the best way for me to deal with it, I think that I dealt with it, was in this level right here, where I talked to a professional. And I just let you talk about,
yep.
I let you show people how confusing, how complex, how yep. how many yep. different, like a octopus or whatever you call it. There's so many things that go with it. You gotta address the trauma, the addictions, maybe the getting someone stable. You know, they may come across a perpetrator. They may, like you said, they may be at a center where the perpetrator is there. And then what the child sees.
Yep. Because kids, they're so impressionable, and you know, the caregivers and the role models, and majority of, basically, if you want to understand how children are, and I hate using the term recruited because it makes it sound like it's from somebody from the outside of this kid's world, but if you want to find out how kids are, quote, recruited, then look at how kids fall into being sexually abused. It's the exact same, and it's usually the same people. Jerome, our executive director, he tells his story. It was, his mother's boyfriend or stepfather. I'm not sure if they were married at the time, but the gentleman groomed mom basically to get to Jerome, and then sexually victimized Jerome, only to basically be conditioning him to then introduce Jerome into the pedophile ring that he was a part of. And so sexual abuse in the home is such a clear pathway. So that is why it goes back to healthy, safe, stable homes are the best, bulletproof vest for these kids, creating a safe and a strong sense of assurance that each child could walk with would be the best vest for these kids to be wearing. I do remember what I was going to say with your, when it comes to, we call them John schools, right? Like a guy who's been arrested for, soliciting sex, and it turns out it was a minor online. And that's, that's what law enforcement shows us. So the effective John schools are when they're able to get the perpetrator to see the object as an individual.
Yep.
And that's what you did. And when that happened, it changed because it was internalized. That it was no longer an object. It was an individual, and that individual had a name. And then it changed for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I almost said it scared the shit out of me, but I don't want to cuss right now, but I'm sleeping in there. I'm used to a fantasy world. There's no name, and you just constantly scroll, and that's when we reach out to people that deal with sex trafficking, because I'm like, if it wasn't for, I know what it made me think about too. I did a podcast about Bernie Madoff and R. Kelly. Basically, if you got a lot of money, what would you really, really do in life when it comes to your sexual desires and things like that? And so we get mad at R. Kelly, kind of rightfully so, because he took it too far. But what if I had a sexual trauma? I become a singer. I become famous. Now I've got millions of dollars. I can pay people behind the table. Like the one dude, who's the guy that got killed? The really rich dude?
Epstein.
Yes. Jeffrey Epstein. Billionaire. A lot of money. He was able to act out his sexual stuff. And it made me think, it's like, there's a lot of people that are really, just probably a lot of people doing that we don't even know. He was a regular businessman, good looking dude, looked like a Polo commercial. You got a job ahead of you, young lady.
Yeah. And, it really is, you talk about it being a hard topic and a hard subject. I mean, I was talking to people about sex trafficking and, rape of kids over a luncheon yesterday. So it was the weirdest, I'm kind of like, maybe I should qualify. We don't need to eat while I talk about, but I mean, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't believe change was possible, and I think that's why I am so, extending the support for survivors. We need more of that. And that's where the task force is focusing, and preventing it before it starts. Because a lot of prevention programs right now, they'll use the word prevent, but they're talking about, curbing your kids' use of social media. And if they're talking to new people, educate them. But that's not prevention, that's intervention. That intervening in the process, that's early intervention. But prevent means stop before it starts. And we could do that, but we're not there yet, systematically, really.
Well, do you have any suggestions or maybe possible techniques for parents out there that you want to share?
So first off, I wrote a book. I don't know if that's
Let's do it. What's the name of the book? Yeah, tell us. Talk to me. What we got?
So I don't even have one in here, but it's called The Insightful Parent, and it's on Amazon, and it is helping parents heal so kids don't have to hurt. Because a healthy parent is able to then see what their child needs, not see through their own needs. Does that make sense? So that's the very, very first thing, because in all my years of counseling, the kids who got well, And I doubt, you know, and I'm still doing it, but you know, there's anxiety, depression, adjustment disorder, family dynamics. And so the typical teenage woes, but the kids who got well and are still well are the kids whose parents came in with them, sat down on the couch and said, how can I help my child? So when I see a parent wanting to be part of the solution, then it's, then we're good, because then I know I've got a parent who I can say, you know, and I can slightly tweak and call out the parent on their triggers and how they're irritating and exacerbating like the stress in their kids. And so the things to look at are really a parent, and my first, I think, three chapters talk about Maslow's hierarchy, and it talks about Erikson's, because if a parent looks at Maslow's hierarchy, it's not only for the professional. And if they look, am I providing basic needs? Am I giving a sense of safety and security to my child? And as a parent, they set the goals to work up there. These are the goals for the kid. And Erikson's stages of development, it goes through the child, you know, 0 to 3. Make sure you attend to your baby when they're crying. That's a physical thing that you can do, because if you don't, the child develops a sense that the world around them isn't safe. And then they internalize that as anxiety. Because if they're crying and a basic need is not being met, then now you've got insecurity and then you've got anxiety. So feeding children, tending to them, you know, physical affection, you know, strong family relationships, spending time, listening to the little things, because if you listen to the little things with your kids, then they'll trust you with the big things. But if you don't make time for the little things, you're telling the kid they don't have value in your home, and then they're not including you. That lets them, you know, then think, well, mom isn't my go-to for this or that.
And then the next go-to would be something like, nowadays kids use the internet. They might meet someone and they might be like, you know, my mom's such and such and such, you know, she's a da-da-da-da. And the person's like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Or why don't you tell this? There's people that can, I think, not a troll. What do you call people that don't use their real name and ID?
Yeah, well, false IDs online. Yeah, false profiles. They create different profiles. Yeah.
And they find these kids and they read their, I heard that they read their website to find kids that are complaining about their mom or complaining about something. And they kind of come in and say, you know what, you're right. You know, yeah. Your mom is like this, or just different things that kind of get in cool with that kid. Next you know, the kid has a new confidant now.
Yeah. Yeah. It, you know, so being that go-to for the kid. And then when we move on to ACEs, I don't believe drug use in the home is a death sentence to a child who's also in that home. But so a past history of drug use is different than I'm in recovery. Mental illness in the home is a risk factor for a child being a victim of trafficking, but it's not a risk factor if that depression is regulated. You know, so the clarification should be, you know, if there's mental illness in the home and it's not causing significant stress on the family, on the child, if the mental illness is regulated and controlled, the child doesn't have a risk. If a child has an incarcerated parent, but the parent who the child is in custody of is providing a healthy, safe, stable environment, then that target of an incarcerated parent is not so big.
Okay, I see what you're saying. There's still the stability and stuff like that.
You can, ACEs, I know, I keep saying it. It's called adverse childhood experiences. So those are 10 markers of like toxic stress situations that have the psychological, you know, American Psychological Association they've just researched these to such a degree. The medical field identifies them because these 10 ACEs, that goes back to when I was talking about any form of abuse, any form of neglect, the incarceration, mental illness in the home, substance abuse in the home. And that's, I'm sure I'm missing one or two in there. So any of those we know, we've researched even physically, cause things like heart disease, cancer, obesity, early death. So physically, ACEs hurt the body. Also, physically, ACEs become targets on kids' backs, and traffickers exploit that because these ACEs create vulnerabilities that the kid doesn't have a strong sense of self. And then they come in and they play mom or they play dad, and they meet that need that that ACE has created.
That clarified a lot for me right there. I see what you're saying now. That's what you mean by these triggers and markers and stuff like that.
Yeah. So that's why it is so preventable.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying now. You see, a kid with those symptoms, like you said, the overweightness or whatever the case may be, traffickers have that sixth sense, and they can link that to some type of insecurity or some type of something else, right?
Well, no, what I'm saying is, so like childhood, you've got these negative experiences. And then as an adult, the medical field knows you can have these physical health experiences as an outcome of it. Yeah. But also, and that's not always, like you can have an obese person that hasn't had trauma. You know, it's not an exact, but also these negative traumas that happen early in childhood, you've got to remember most traffickers are known to the child and family. So it's not like the trafficker is that online profile. That trafficker just finished watching dad slap you across the face. So that then that uncle is kind of like, let's go for a walk. It's so much closer to home than we're trained to think, you know? So you're looking at ACEs, and then the neighbor comes in. And I'm sorry, I keep saying ACEs. It is that adverse childhood experiences, right? Yeah. So any of those markers, and then the neighbor comes in, the stepdad comes in, the stepmom, the aunt, it's people we know, love, and trust. The same people who are sexual abusers, that's primarily the gateway to a child becoming trafficked. And once they're trafficked, then they'll, and this is younger, I'm speaking adolescent, you know, children, and then older with survivors, it's usually, it is that it's still kind of a boyfriend or it's still someone in your circle of trust. That movie, Liam Neeson, right? With the movie Taken that Liam Neeson was in years ago. Did you ever see it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wait, the little girl? Wait, no. Yeah.
His daughter, and she goes to Europe, right? So it's a great Hollywood movie to watch, but mistakenly, people have used that to assign what they think trafficking looks like. And that is the most marginal, tiny. That's not the majority. The majority is that kid trafficked in plain sight by family. Well, it starts with family. I can't say like forever they're trafficked by family, right?
Earlier, maybe about 5 or 10 minutes ago, I said, you got a higher job, but you've got a higher job than I thought 10 minutes ago. because most people think of the trafficker. I'm not prejudiced about different cultures, but a lot of people are like, okay, trafficker. You got this Russian guy, you got this Russian mafia over here, and they're
stealing paying American babies.
They're secretly shipping them off somewhere, and then the cops come and bust them, and the guys just get slapped on the wrist, and they keep on moving you. And that's what you picture, but you're right. It's the uncle, the stepdad is the...
Yeah. You know, and it starts there, or, you know, a community friend that the child confides in because their family is emotionally abusive. And so it's quite often the pathway into trafficking. Because I won't speak once somebody's deep in the trenches, because the dark web is a real thing and strangers are actually buying kids. And, you know, I mean, it's disgusting. The dark web goes to the degree of, you've got these forums where people are buying and selling kids, but the ticket into the forum is sending a picture or video of you sexually violating a child. And so if you're willing to put your stuff out there, okay, well, now we trust you because we've got you on video. Now you can come into our chat room.
Man,
So that legit is out there, you know? So that's happening along with, that's why I say monsters hide in plain sight. It starts local, you know? And then you've also got this very dark unseen, which this is unseen as well. So it's really, it's tough to ever think we're gonna stay ahead of traffickers if we only focus on recovering and the law enforcement side. We've got to work toward restoring the family to take those targets off the kids' backs.
So what's that called again? It's not recovery, it's not prevention, it's before prevention. What do you say?
Well, targeted prevention is what I was calling.
Yeah.
Technically it's prevention, but we're out there calling prevention intervention. So I just apparently need to add an adjective to the word prevention, so we're actually doing it.
I get you. Oh my goodness. And now I got personal question for you still.
Yeah.
So I was blessed the one time when I was probably maybe six-ish, a neighbor down the street. We were all playing outside. I was about six-ish, he was probably 18-ish, 17-ish maybe-ish, around there. And he lured me in because we were playing with cars outside. And he gave me the promise of some little car or something like that. That's the basics of it. It took me, I didn't address it until, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a professional in this field. How long did it take for you to get to the point where you were able to address it? And
the benefit, you're right, because I'm a professional and I'm a recovering perfectionist, which is also part a byproduct of trauma. Like anybody who struggles with perfection, they just need to look back in their history and see what happened. Because it's, perfectionism is this need to control. Well, why do you need to control, you know? So when I started doing my undergrad work, I was between 22 and 24 is when I really started the best portion of my healing journey. So that was 12 years after it happened. And you're on point though, because just yesterday with the Father Factory, he was on a webinar, and on average it takes men 20 years to begin their identification of trauma to even then start the journey of recovery and healing.
Yeah, so for me, if it wasn't for me getting a sense of spirituality and these different things I want to do for God, God literally forcing me to do this,
yep,
I probably don't think I would have ever addressed it, because even when I did address it, I literally, when I stopped and thought about that instance, I literally was talking to my friend for a hot second about it, and I literally started crying. I was crying, shaking, just bawling. It was like, and I hadn't even opened everything up yet. Just the beginning stages, I was a freaking wreck.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta move forward with the rest of this. And for like a week, I had like gotten high off and on. I just didn't want to face it. I got high off and on, and then I got high and I'd be like, I'm looking at the same stuff that happened to me. It just has so many layers. Like you said, there's a lot of layers. So what was the person that made you decide to crack it open or take a look at it? Was something you came across from school all of a sudden, or were you like, you know what, let me just face this thing?
I think between school, so to be a good social worker while somebody's going through school, I really think they need to kind of do some soul scraping, because whatever ugly unresolved stuff I have is going to get in the way of me helping others. That's the way I view, that's kind of my philosophy. And so this is a barrier, this is coming up because I'm here learning classes about individual therapy and how to help other people, and I'm kind of like, So, for me, school was a big component. And then I also had an 18-month-old at the time. And so I didn't want to, a lot of people will experience a surge of triggers or I want to call it relapse in their recovery when their child reaches the age of victimization.
I can see that.
You know, and so as they have a kid, the closer their kids get into a certain age, they need to pay attention to, have I gone through, because I think recovering from trauma is truly like an onion. And you can peel it a lot, but there's always a new layer with a new season of life. And it might be a thick or it might be a thin layer. But the most random things. And so both the child and going through school is what made me want to, you know, kind of push through. And I'm the type of person that if I have a feeling, I like to dive in and explore, as scary as it is, versus like step back and, you know, run the other direction. Like I kind of get into all the junk to figure it out. And so it's also just my personality to press in and do it now, you know? Yeah. Oh, but I'll tell you what my trigger was. Oh, yeah. So that was my why, but my final straw was at a relative's wedding when I had a second cousin who was a grown adult sitting on the perpetrator's lap at a wedding. But Perp is married in the family, 60 plus year old, and this is 25 year old granddaughter sitting on lap. It just, and then, and that was one of a couple of other things, and I won't disclose the other ones. There was enough of, when I could put pieces together that I was not the only one, then I was willing to stand up and wave the flag.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. See, and people that, like you said, I hate to say it, sometimes you have to have a trial to have a testimony. Mm-hmm. But you're a good example of, you know what I'm saying, you went through something and you use your own process.
Yep.
And like they say, got it done.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'm gonna do a follow-up. Let me see, I'm gonna pay attention. Oh my goodness, mess around with you, Amanda. Here's what we're gonna do. I definitely wanna do a follow-up with you because I want to do a follow-up on the individual process. Not so much the trafficking now. We got the basics out there, the definitions out there, the different levels of it. I want to focus. We're going to do another episode at another day on the process, like the personal process, things you can do, like what you did, what I did, the personal processes that can help the parent of that had been molested, maybe whatever case may be, help that parent. Because you said a lot of times, if the parent can help their own situation.
Yeah, it takes targets off their kids' backs. The healthier we are as parents, the safer our children are.
There it is. So next,
I mean, that's a big deal. Yeah.
So we're going to take targets off our kids' backs next episode. All right, there it is. Yeah, let's flex on it. All right, well, this is, so here's how I usually end it. I usually say, hey, that's a wrap for episode 180. 181 is next, and I have no clue what it's going to be about. But when I know, I'll let you know. That's usually how I wrap it up. But when I have a special guest, I like to let my guest say the parting words, and then I'll wrap it up. So, first off, your book, The Insightful Parent.
Yep.
That's on Amazon. Wait, what's it on Amazon?
That is on Amazon, yep. Or they can check out my website at theinsightfulparent.com.
Okay, so the book and the website, The Insightful Parent and theinsightfulparent.com, Amanda Corbin. So give us your final one. What's the main, give us a headline. What's a point that you really want us to walk away with for this episode? What's something you really want to just let the public know is a very important thing that's on your heart?
I, in the deepest part of me, believe that human trafficking is preventable. And it's preventable if parents will take the time to help themselves and then give their best self to their kids. And by that, we're gonna put the best bulletproof on the kids than we could in any other way is probably what I'd say.
That's it. I can't say it any better, and I'm not gonna say it any better. Okay. Thank you, Amanda Corbin. Next episode we're doing is gonna be about bulletproofing our kids.
That's awesome. Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome. Thanks again. And we'll be doing it soon again.
Yay. All right.
Amanda Corbin, the author of The Insightful Parent.
You're awesome. Thank you. Bye.